You're listening to the Partially Examined Life, a philosophy podcast by some folks who at one point set on doing philosophy for a living, but then thought better of it. Our question for episode 49 is something like, are we really free? And we read Michel Foucault's 1975 book, Discipline and Punish, at least the first few chapters of it. For a link to this text and other information, check out partiallyexaminedlife.com. My name is Mark Lintonmeyer, heard by you all, yet hearing none of you from Madison, Wisconsin.
This is Seth Paskin in Austin, Texas.
This is Wes Allen in Boston, Massachusetts.
This is Dylan Casey, panoptically, from Middleton, Wisconsin.
This is Katie McIntyre from New York, New York.
Wow, five people. We've never done that before. There might be an explosion of some sort.
So, Katie, how did you get in on this?
Well, I am currently dissertating on Michel Foucault.
At Columbia, right?
Yep, that's right. I started having an interest in Foucault as an undergraduate, and it stuck with me.
And she's one of the people when I was spamming various graduate departments to tell them about the podcast who actually replied to me and said, that's great. And then I looked her up and saw that she was a Foucault person. I immediately asked her to be on a Foucault episode, and that was like a year and a half ago, I believe.
Wow. See, spam can lead to good things.
Yeah, you guys were hilarious. I was sucked in. What can I say?
Before we go further, I want to say this podcast is supported by our listeners. There's a $1 suggested donation if you like what we're doing here. Thanks to all of you that paid that last time around and or purchased the recordings, t-shirt, music, and other things from our website. And a special big thanks to the big donors, which this time were Sean Parker, Marcus Neugierg, and Scott Davis. We also have a sponsorship for this episode from Audible, featuring the largest selection of digital audiobooks available on the planet. And if listeners in the U.S. or Canada go to audiblepodcast.com/PEL... you get a free audiobook. For instance, our very next episode is going to be on Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance. I saw they have that in abridged and unabridged, and even a secondary source about that. Also, we have a philosophy and race one coming up featuring things by Cornel West. Buy something by him if you want.
Buy things.
In any case, I hope you do not hate us because there was a commercial there.
And that's just the tip of the iceberg. There's more to come on the commercial front.
Maybe. If the sponsors are worthy, I am free within the structure set out by the man.
System.
I'm trying to speak Foucault and failing very badly.
Yeah.
I don't think Foucault says the man once in this.
That's just the translation. If it was German, it would be Das Mann for sure.
For sure.
You've boiled it down to 60s jargon. The system.
He was on the tail end of it. He was very influenced by that whole thing. I was reading his biography and how he was in the Communist Party when he was younger in the 50s, but really wasn't very active. But then he was very active as a general liberal rabble rouser and like getting things fighting with police and stuff.
Which biography? I'm curious.
This was just on Wikipedia.
That's the extent of my two-second research.
Katie, tell us about why you love him. What is cool about his life or his work?
His life I'm not getting into. It's a whole Pandora's box. But what's interesting about his work is the ways in which he gets us to question certain aspects of our lives that we sort of take for granted as just being normal or very natural or somehow necessary. He tries to unhinge all of that, I think, pretty successfully.
Do you have a dissertation topic?
Yeah. So Foucault's got his ideas about power and how they shape individuals and what we as individuals even take ourselves to be. And there's this criticism in the secondary literature that this makes everything too deterministic, that we're not free in our actions. We just do what this thing called power tells us to do. So if that's the case, then how could we ever criticize these systems that we're in? What would be the basis for such a criticism? What would be the resources that individual actors would have to level such a criticism? Answering this question first requires a lot of clarifications to be made about Foucault's work. There's some misinterpretation going on. And once we see that, we actually have a lot of options. It's going to be okay. That's the message.
One of the criticism of Foucault relies on a kind of interpretation of a deterministic dynamic that all power is Newtonian, essentially.
A microphysics of power.
Yeah, a Newtonian microphysics of power. Efficient cause, you know, that whole nine yards.
That's a way of understanding it. So the idea that I think is wrong is that power somehow causes our actions or causes our thoughts. Actually, what I'm working on right now is trying to demonstrate that it's not actually a relationship of cause, but one of motivation pushing us in a direction, but not a relationship of cause in the scientific sense. And that makes all the difference in the world.
Well, this particular book wasn't so much about like Nietzsche's will to power, right? And Foucault describes himself as a Nietzschean. So listeners, go listen to our Nietzsche Genealogy of Morals episode.
Which was awesome.
Yes. Because he's giving throughout in this book and in a lot of his other works is giving a very historical story that very much is like the story Nietzsche gives, but with a lot more actual historical detail and research seemingly into it. Whereas for Nietzsche, will to power might be something like Freud's id or some kind of causal force within us. Power. We do everything for the sake of power. It seems like at least in this work, we're sort of all victims of power. And in fact, power doesn't even necessarily have to be exerted by an individual. It could sort of be set up in the system or something. From that standpoint, what you're saying about us being motivated by power, well, the motivation is because there are these powers that we're being subjected to and kind of influencing us to do things in certain ways. Is that what you're talking about, or are there just other works?
Yeah, that's the general idea. It persists in at least the works of the mid to late 70s.
I mainly want to understand what power is, and since we have someone who's read a lot of Foucault, I hadn't read him since I was an undergrad, and I wasn't sure I understood what power was then either. So before getting into discipline, is there a way for me to understand what he means by power? And I assume it's just a perfectly ordinary French word. It's not the same thing as like dunamis or what Aristotle would talk about.
No. You have asked the question.
So what are the six answers about it?
So I'll tell you what I think the answer is.
Can you also tell us what other people think, too?
Yes, I
tell me what I think.
Well, no, I mean, you have certainly read more of the secondary literature than I have, given that I have read none of it. So it would be interesting to hear your presentation of what the controversies are.
Sure, you're in luck. This is chapter one of the dissertation. What is power? Writing it right now.
Perfect.
Discipline is merely one form that power takes. These are not synonymous terms. I think that's going to be one of the first problems you encounter in the secondary literature is a conflation between Foucault's general notion of power and Foucault's elaboration of discipline.
Just for listeners, so we're not even really going to talk much about discipline today, but it's what you think it means. It's like what the military does. It's what your teacher is doing to make you sit down and do your work. That's not a technical term.
Yes.
It doesn't necessarily imply punishment. Wouldn't training be included under discipline?
Absolutely. I think training is the key word here. Yes.
Okay. But it's self-training too. I mean, in the perfectly ordinary sense. If I discipline myself, if I try to do something and I follow a regimen and I'm very disciplined about that, those are all copacetic with Foucault.
Yes, absolutely. This is what schools are for getting you to discipline yourself, to internalize the discipline that's been imposed on you from the teacher or the military officer or the factory foreman. It's the same figure recurring in all of these contexts. And the goal is to get you to discipline yourself so that power works ever more efficiently.
I'm linking this back to the Nietzsche episode we did. Really implicitly, Nietzsche is talking a lot about discipline in the Genealogy of Morals, but it's related to will. And the idea is that when you say you will do something, when you make a promise, that you can keep it. And that takes a certain kind of self-control and training.
I think this is exactly related to what Nietzsche says in the Genealogy about how you breed an animal with the right to make promises. That's just exactly what Foucault's talking about. Yeah.
So power is not discipline. So what is the
alternative? So what's power? Looking at Foucault's works as a whole, I think what you get is a picture of power in which power is something that's rather uninteresting. It's the ways that actions shape other actions. Power emerges in interaction between individuals. So what this means for Foucault is that it implies that a series of negative claims. Power is not something that people have. It's not a commodity. It's not something that's exercised on individuals themselves, but on their actions. So whenever you have a situation of one action motivating another, power emerges in that relationship. Power isn't either good or bad. It's just something that happens.
And it seems like, and I might just be relying on this particular text too much, but his focus on the idea of surveillance, I think we can link that to a lot of different things we've talked about. So for instance, for Freud, the way people are disciplined is that Freud talks about the development of the superego by identifying with, say, teachers and parents. And the idea is that you are trying to achieve a certain kind of recognition. And then we talked about similar concepts of recognition in, say, Hegel and Rousseau. So the idea seems to be that recognition is playing a critical role here in the exercise of power. In other words, that we are attuned to what other people desire, what other people approve of, what other people disapprove of. That's one of the mechanisms of power.
I think that's a connection that sometimes gets overlooked. Foucault doesn't exactly talk about recognition per se, but I think that's what he has in mind when he's talking about are conforming with the norm. Why do we do that? Well, we need to be seen as fitting into this society, and we need to be recognized as part of the group.
Let me use that answer to segue to what could be, say, by Seth, a summary of the text. And my segue is to connect it to the question that I opened this with, which I was trying to figure out, you know, what is the question? Is it, what's the purpose of punishment? But as I got into the book, I felt like as far as modern application is, the reason why we care about this whole inquiry that he's doing here in this book is, are we really free? That is, if we understand the power relations around us, and it's not just the man is out to get you, and that's now how they get you. It's not just that kind of conspiracy theory power stuff. It's every time you are influenced by something, that's something exerting power over you. And that's not necessarily a bad thing. But I guess if it's the kind of thing that when you do this examination and you find that the things that have power over you are not things that you would like to have power over you, then you find that, in fact, you are not free. You might have thought you were, but this is a false consciousness, as the Marxists might say.
Well, I'm a little wary of this talk of freedom, because I think freedom is in opposition to being caused or overpowered. I'm sympathetic to Hume's compatibilism. The idea is that, yes, you can be motivated. You can have a certain type of personality and predispositions, which are the results of power in some sense, right? And that doesn't really mean that you're not free. The concept of freedom that you're trying to save in that isn't really coherent on further examination of this idea of radical freedom, where we're meant to be unmoored from our character and from our tendencies and all those sorts of things.
Well, I was trying to be neutral about a theory of freedom in the way I was setting that forth, but it's perfectly compatible with a more Nietzschean idea of freedom.
Yeah, you're right.
Where if I sort of identify with what I'm doing, then I'm free. If I'm doing something under coercion or covert coercion or because I'm being dominated in some way, then I'm not free. That's all.
Where coercion doesn't have to be gunpoint, right? You could just have bad habits.
I think you're right, but it does connect to political freedom, given what I little bit I said about his biography. Like, that, I think, is his ultimate motivation here. Is he thinks Marxism is too much of a straitjacket. He's not down with the Marxist theory in terms of the overly simplistic analysis a Marxist would give of history. He's very non-reductionist. He wants to give the historical details and do an analysis like that.
I'm just going to give the readers a heads up that if you go into this book thinking this is a discussion of freedom or how free you are in a society, the first paragraph you read is going to disabuse you of that notion very quickly. May I quote?
Please.
Please do.
Oh, great.
It's such a wonderful passage.
This is the very first paragraph of this book.
I knew you would like this, Seth.
On 2nd of March, 1757, Damiens the Regicide was condemned to make an amende honorable before the main door of the Church of Paris, where he was to be taken and conveyed in a cart, wearing nothing but a shirt, holding a torch of burning wax weighing 2 pounds. Then in said cart, to the Place de Grève, where on a scaffold that will be erected there, the flesh will be torn from his breasts, arms, thighs, and calves with red-hot pincers, his right hand holding the knife with which he committed the said parricide, burnt with sulfur, and on those places where the flesh will be torn away, poured molten lead, boiling oil, burning resin, wax, and sulfur melted together, and then his body drawn and quartered by 4 horses, and his limbs and body consumed by fire, reduced to ashes, and his ashes thrown to the winds.
And that's just the short version of the... Yeah,
this goes on for 3 pages.
Yes.
And we get the longer account.
And we're not going to read any more details like that because you get the idea.
And there's plenty of it.
But those were the good old days where power was more obvious. It was wielded more explicitly and obviously, right?
Right, exactly. That's what's interesting about these new disciplinary forms of power is that they operate surreptitiously. You don't even notice the ways in which you're being influenced by them.
Yeah.
So in a way, it's more dangerous because it's easy to identify the source of power when you're looking at a model of sovereignty or the spectacle of punishment. It's easy to say, oh, that's the source of my domination. Let's just get rid of the king. But it's much harder when it's masked and distributed in these institutions in which we ourselves participate, all of that.
Yes. So it takes Foucault a little while to get to the point that Katie just brought up from this original description of this torture and at the beginning of the book. He starts here, obviously, for a purpose. And the purpose, I think, is he wants to talk about the transition of a system of punishment that was in place, I guess, prior to the revolution. I don't want to go so far as to align it specifically with a particular historical period, but...
He said 18th to 19th. Yeah, 18th century is the before.
Most crimes were essentially violent and affected on persons' bodies, and then the punishment was on the offender's body. That the system of punishment that existed was essentially to extract some kind of justice. I don't know if that's the right word.
Revenge.
Or some kind of revenge, retribution on the body of the criminal. This was done very publicly as an expression of the sovereign's power and with the complicity of the public. And he needs to establish this because he's going to talk about how it transitions from that to this idea of discipline and system, which is going to go along with the change in the social order as well.
And this is a good place to bring up. So I put up a post on partiallyexaminedlife.com before we recorded this a couple weeks and invited people to ask questions. So there's one question by a guy named who calls himself Voltard on there, where he says, Foucault dismisses concepts such as human nature, universal human rights, justice, humanism, objective truth, etc. And is he obsessed with what is perhaps the central issue of his work, namely power? I don't get it. We've already said a little bit about what his concept of power is and why he's concerned with it. But in terms of this narrative, the thing that he's trying to fight against is it's very natural to think, oh, those people were a bunch of savages. And then we got the notions of human rights. We had great reformers like Jeremy Bentham and John Stuart Mill, perhaps, and a bunch of French guys whose names I don't remember, who argued that we should punish more humanely. And so we started doing that, and the sovereign lost power, and just everybody became more free and happy. And that's exactly what Foucault wants to argue against. Yes, there was a change. It was more a change just because it wasn't working that well, the old system, for various reasons. But power is still exerted in the new system. It's just in a different, more subtle way.
Right.
Yeah, well, the old system was becoming a little more dangerous for the sovereign. Foucault puts this emphasis on the ways in which things could go wrong and the crowd might end up sympathizing with the person who is being publicly tortured and executed. And when power is wielded in such obvious ways, it subjects you to some danger, right? It's when it goes underground that you get a much nicer and safer form of control.
He also makes the point, maybe later on, that this genealogy depends a lot on the development of the mercantile economy and other forces in the social order that makes it much more palatable for such a rise of discipline. In fact, it's not clear to me that he would say that discipline was born exactly. Maybe he would say that, but it seems to me it's a question of which kind of display or form of power comes to dominate within a society, and that it's certainly not as if there wasn't such a thing as discipline before 1800s.
No, yeah. I think you're right. You're right. Yeah.
I mean, the Roman armies were full of discipline, right?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. This is another feature of power in general for Foucault, is that it's going to be self-organizing. So you do end up with fluctuations in which specific form of power becomes most pervasive. As norms get reinforced more effectively by certain means, those means become the dominant means.
Did Foucault ever analyze Sparta?
Not as far as I know.
Because that seems to me like the perfect example of something almost like a panoptic society. It's incredibly disciplined. There are specific rules for everybody. Everybody knows what everybody else is doing. And it's obviously and self-consciously a form of education, both militarily and culturally. We don't have to try to make that analysis ourselves. It strikes me that it can't possibly be the case that discipline as a form of power is something that's sort of born now. It has got to be more to do with the way it is kind of transition.
It would probably be unfair to characterize Foucault as saying that discipline is something that emerges with the rise of the middle class and mercantilism and the overthrow of the monarchy and this sort of ushering into a modern industrial age. His concept of discipline in this book is tied to the system of observation and the idea of a society that is ordered under this power structure that Katie mentioned, where people are essentially influenced to police themselves out of fear of being caught. But I feel like we might be jumping ahead and we should roll back a little bit. There's a reason he spends a fair amount of time on this initial section, establishing what he calls an economy of punishment underneath the sovereign and the system that we have, and then it transitions from that to this other model.
Well, let's return to that criticism later, though, after we... Because I think Dylan's question there is important.
I think it's a fair question. So where would you like us to begin?
I was flabbergasted at how long we spent on punishment when it seems to be his most important conclusion had to do with discipline. So trying to lay out why it matters so much to spend 150 pages on punishment and the transition. And he has really three stages, right? Or three ways of organizing punishment: monarchical law, reforming jurists, and the prison. And then he calls them three technologies of power regarding punishment. And then it's from there that we have the transition into this new form of discipline. Saying why he does that and why it's necessary is, I think, worthwhile.
So why don't we talk about some of the characteristics of the system of punishment that he lays out in the initial section, and this idea that punishment is a manifestation of the power of the sovereign. So a crime against the body politic is a crime against the king. The king is in a position where the king needs to express and maintain his power over the populace. And punishment in this very public forum is one way in which that is accomplished. But it's important that there's a whole system that supports this model that's going to turn out to change quite a bit over time. So, for example, the accused is not permitted to view the evidence against him or her. There's a panel of judges or some sort of an executor or magistrate who represents the sovereign, and he decides whether the accused is guilty or innocent. Foucault makes a point of talking about how torture was employed as a way to ensure that the accused would confess. So in other words, guilt is already determined without what we would consider to be a trial or a fair hearing or an evidentiary inquisition. The idea of the inquisition existed, but it all takes place in secrecy behind closed doors. So that's important that we understand that when the crime occurs and then the criminal is incarcerated pending the punishment, all of what we would consider to be standard mechanisms of the judicial system are in secret. The punishment itself, however, is quite public. And this will become important later, obviously, because those two things are flip-flopped when we get to the system of discipline. So he does spend a fair amount of time talking about how this is really almost like a theater and less what we would consider to be a system of justice. Punishment is tied not so much to a system of justice, but to a system of torture, where the criminal is essentially compelled under this power structure to take part or is tortured into complicity.
What's the conceit behind that structure, the kind of defense that you would make of it? Ignoring the torture part, the idea of having an authority that makes decisions for those they have authority over, it's like a family. The kids don't make decisions, really. The parents make decisions for the good of the children, and that's their job. And if they don't do that, then they've failed in that job. And if you take it seriously, ignoring potentials of corruption and stuff like that, a king is the father of his subjects and is responsible for their well-being. And therefore, his judgment is the only judgment that makes sense. I'm saying that only to try to make sense of why you would start with that kind of system. There's a reason why this structure exists, and there's a way of defending it, even if it doesn't hold up in the end. And that's what I'm trying to reach for. It's not about capricious torture. That's not the goal of it, right?
Absolutely not.
No, certainly not. It has its own logic of operation, or it wouldn't have been implemented in the first place. The public spectacle of torture works, right? You don't want to be tortured. So you don't do whatever it was that guy did, the one who's being tortured, right? I mean, it makes very good sense. And in terms of the sovereignty issue, the transgressive act, the crime, is, as you said, a crime against the sovereign. And the sovereign's power has to be restored publicly. The public has to have the absolute knowledge that it is the sovereign who lays down the law. That's why this exercise of power has to be so public. It's reestablishing who's in charge.
Right. It's described as if you commit a crime, it's an act of war on your part.
Right.
Yeah.
I'm brought to mind of that image of the sovereign on the cover of the standard edition of Hobbes' Leviathan.
Mm-hmm. I was just thinking of that, yeah.
The criminal act is essentially a metaphorical crime against the body of the sovereign, and so the punishment is extracted on the body of the criminal.
Yeah.
Well, that image, the body of the sovereign, is composed of a bunch of the people, right, Seth?
Mm-hmm. And so Dylan was saying, what's the conceit behind this? And when you said that, and the way I think about it when I read it is, this is sort of the Hobbesian archetype in play. That he's talking about how punishment and how power works in the dynamic of the Hobbesian sovereign.
I just want to point out the importance here of the punishment being enacted on the body, because this, I think, is going to be an important switch in disciplinary power. It's the body of the criminal that's punished, and the only relevant question is, was this act committed by this person? They don't care about questions that are going to come up later, like, what kind of person is this? Does this person have a criminal nature? There's nothing like that. There's no reference to what's going on in the mind of the individual, and there's no effort to change the minds of individuals. It's about discouraging criminal actions only.
Right.
Yeah, that's a critical point. Did anybody else feel like this is like retributive justice in like the old school, like biblical sense?
Well, he says, I mean, that's part of the reason for the extreme continuing to torture the body after the person is dead, bringing the person to the point of death and like reviving them and then torturing some more to the point of death. These things that if you try to actually implement an eye for an eye, then if somebody does something bad enough, you can't implement that. And for instance, a regicide, since you're just a peon subject and you're killing or even attempting to kill somebody whose life is worth so much more than yours, then by that Old Testament logic, you should be killed multiple times. Yeah, he refers to somebody writing a political essay of like, you know, why hanging is not bad enough or something.
That brings up another point too, sort of piggybacking on what Katie said. It's very focused on the body. It's just a question of guilt or innocence. There's no such thing as a mitigating circumstance. Not interested in reforming the criminal, not interested in understanding motivations. Nobody cares. Or I should say, it's not part of the, as Foucault would say, the economy of this system.
Exactly.
To account for those things. And another aspect of it is that it's completely up to the discretion of the authorities in the particular case to determine the punishment. So this particular punishment is an extreme example, but it's not unique. And that you get into this system where they're trying to devise tortures to match what they consider to be the heinousness of the crime, that there's no system or no ledger that says, for this crime, this is the appropriate punishment, or for this crime, this is the appropriate punishment. Instead, in every single case, the individuals involved make the decision about what's to be. And that's why you have all of these unbelievably, just folks listening, he's got example after example in this book of terrible things that are done to people. It's not sufficient to simply imitate what's previously been done. There's a sense of creativity that comes into play. So it's chaotic, it's uneven, but it all stems from this, it all flows from this authority of the sovereign. So there's a sense in which just by exacting that retribution on the body of the criminal, you're accomplishing the goal within the economy of the system as it stands in that era.
And so political economy, this term, he likes to put these slightly disparate terms together, right? Like the microphysics of power we already saw and the technology of the body, these other things like that. And so I guess what I was interpreting political economy is talking about is just really how much effort does it take to achieve this political purpose? And that's ultimately what makes this type of a punishment doomed, because if you're doing it in a public spectacle, well, then there's too much risk of the public, for instance, especially if they don't agree with the verdict, rebelling against that. Or he talks about the public taking it as a sign if something goes wrong. So the person is hung, but the scaffold doesn't quite work. And so they're not dead yet. So there's a definite sense that, well, you should let him off. It's sort of like a trial by combat. He talks about the executioner being the king's representative in combat with the person to be executed. Of course, very stacked contest. And so that's why I was very illuminated by this phrase, and he shall be hung by the neck until dead. That they actually had to say that because sometimes it wouldn't work the first time and they wanted to cut off the people rising up. And so why the thing shifted is all about these calculations of political economy. It was just because this is supposed to be a massive deterrent. And it didn't work. It didn't work in the shifting times when there were more people and the standard of living was higher and the types of crimes were less and the political environment was changing. And it just didn't work anymore.
Right. He even talks about sort of this cultural realization that the severity of the punishment, the gruesomeness of the punishment, was seen to exceed the crime. And that's where the economy of power now is off balance, right? The debt being paid is greater, or the punishment is greater than the actual debt owed. And when this was sort of realized on a wide scale, the system couldn't be maintained anymore. It was too open to criticism.
I was trying to get at how we're using the word economy here, because it sounded like when you just were using it, you're just using economy as the balance of power, but the balance of power is supposed to be extremely out of whack in favor of the sovereign. That's the whole point. But a calculation of political economy is, if you're the sovereign, then whatever the forces are that are trying to keep order in society, what is the cheapest way to make that happen? And if you have the populace, as they're supposed to, helping out and going along and being witnesses to the guilt of this person and the rightness of the sovereign, then it's working according to this political economy. But if they're not, if they feel sorry because this punishment is just so horrible that it elicits pity, then that throws the political economy off. It necessitates a different decision.
You're absolutely right. I think Foucault talks about the economy of all sorts of things, and the economy of punishment is this relationship of the criminal being indebted. But yes, you're absolutely right. What we were talking about with the political economy is, how much does it cost the sovereign to exert his power? And if everybody's going along with it, it doesn't cost him very much. But when it gets harder and harder to implement, maybe we want to look for a cheaper mode of power.
Also, what throws that balance off is the inherent contradiction between the need to make the sentence legible on the body of the criminal and then the pettiness of newer crimes, right? Yep. So to make the sentence legible on the body means to do these horrible things, to torture. That's part of what makes it this very public thing. And that's great if the criminal is a regicide or an attempted regicide. But if it's shoplifting, if the sentiments of the public say that, you know, the punishment must fit the crime, well, you can't take the shoplifter up and slap them on the wrist. That's not exactly making the sentence legible anymore. So there's an inherent contradiction between the types of crimes that are being committed and this need for legibility or for visibility.
Russ, you hit on something that I was wondering about, which is, isn't it the case that the kinds of crimes that the sovereign wants to punish are going to be changing or are changing? So that part of that economy is that the very pieces of the economy that need to be controlled now are changing, so that you can't have this kind of punishment regime anymore. Because, I mean, for instance, you're not going to, Wes gave the example of shoplifting, but if we take the extreme example now of white collar crime, any of those sorts of things that have to do with the functioning of something like the monetary economy, are the development of mercantilism and the merchant class and all those sorts of things. You're going to have all kinds of crimes that you want to punish because you want to dissuade people from committing them, but now you no longer have the means to punish them properly. to me, that makes a little bit more sense of this transition. There's sort of the fact of the transition, but there's a kind of underlying dynamic behind that transition regarding what sorts of things the society as a... If I think of these powers as being the things that hold the society together as a society, and different sorts of society have different balances or physics behind them, to use Foucault's way of speaking, then the transition is going to be facilitated or prompted by a change in the kinds of society that you're going to have. It's going to demand a new kind of underlying physics. Now, it might have its own problems, which Foucault wants to highlight.
Yeah, there's a reason why he's using the word micro, and it's, I think, Dylan, you're right. There's a correlation between the magnitude of the offenses and the magnitude of the exertion of power, and power goes underground, or power becomes micro, just at the point where, I guess, the certain changes in the economy and other things make for many micro sorts of crimes.
So maybe we should talk about this term microphysics a bit, actually. So what Foucault says is that, I'm quoting now, the history of this microphysics of punitive power would then be a genealogy or an element in a genealogy of the modern soul. I think there is so much packed into this sentence that it might be worth talking about for a minute, at least what he means by microphysics. What he's doing is he's looking at the microphysics of punitive power, of the power to punish. And I think one thing he means by microphysics is what we've already been saying about the magnitude of the crime. How big is the problem we're dealing with? That kind of question. Is it a big problem? Is it a small problem? He also, once he gets to disciplinary power, starts talking about how the body is broken down into ever smaller units to be trained. And I think that is an important element in this microphysics of punitive power. How does it act on the small units of the body? But I think there's another sense of microphysics here that's really important and applies to his project pretty generally. What microphysics means to a physicist, and I know because I asked one before I started talking to you guys.
Thank God, because there's no physicists on this call.
Microphysics is the level of physics where the classical Newtonian model doesn't work anymore. And I think this is so linked to what Foucault is trying to do when he gets into disciplinary power. The old model of power, the model of the sovereign, doesn't capture what's going on with disciplinary power. Our classical model of power that we all walk around with implicitly, that power is exercised from the top down, that sort of thing, that classical model has to be thrown out the window when you get to disciplinary power. And I think that's maybe an important sense of microphysics that we should keep in mind.
I think part of that's going to have to be tied up in the need in whatever this new version of society is. It's going to demand a technology that goes down to that level.
Right.
Those societies worked, right? I mean, in the sense that they had their own rules. Putting aside questions of judgment about their justice, it's amounts to saying they have their own dynamic. And it's a top-down dynamic. And one of the consequences is, for instance, that you're not really a criminal unless you get caught. People are constantly getting out of the jurisdiction. It's like the Wild West. Whereas, you know, in this new era of discipline, you have the need to get down to a level of social, this micro level that doesn't admit of this classical version of power for the same reason why it works in physics, right? It's not like classical physics doesn't work. It's that classical physics doesn't work down to a certain level. Once you get to a certain scale, you need to start paying attention to other kinds of interactions and other ways of interacting that are not classical anymore.
The basic idea is that power is decentralized, that it's not just the sovereign, or by analogy in physics, one body acting on another impassive body, although we know that even at the Newtonian level, that's not exactly the best way to put it. But power is distributed among all agents or all human beings, or really you could say it's in the system, let's say, or it's outside of them. It's that micro.
It's relational?
Yeah.
Well, the other thing about micro too, he's getting at the division of space and time. You know, he likes those timetables, but even the idea of making a schedule, you know, it occurs to me when people say they're busy or I'm tending to my calendar, the way I've divided up the day, you know, we're no longer torturing and dividing up bodies into pieces. We divide up our days into pieces. We torture out our days, and that's the way we apply discipline to ourselves. So that's, it's micro in that sense. We do a lot of dividing in our discipline.
Is that a self-confessional analogy, or is that a from someone who prefers not to be disciplined about what he does from minute to minute?
What do you mean?
You using that phrase makes me think either it's a, yes, this is the modern age. We all torture ourselves and divide our days like this. Or you suckers torture yourselves and divide your days. But I am too smart for that.
No, I'm trying to paraphrase the argument. I independent of what I, whether I agree with it or not. Yes, it does occur to me that people can be overscheduled and then I can be overscheduled and those sorts of things. But I haven't made an evaluation of whether I think that argument works. I just I see that as part of the argument.
Yeah, this is something that Foucault talks about, right? Immediately after that description of the regicide being drawn and quartered and tortured in various ways, the very next thing he gives you is a timetable from like 70 years later, 80 years later, something like that.
Yeah.
And it's so detailed. It's what the prisoners are going to do every 15 minutes, right? And I think the idea there, to link this back to the micro discussion, is that the smaller divisions you make in how these prisoners are supposed to use their time, every minute is accounted for. There's no time for criminal activity when you have to be out of bed at 5 a.m., dressed by 5:15, at breakfast at 5:30, out in the workyard at 5:45. And that's something Foucault is going to link to the ways we organize institutions now. I mean, I think one of the main takeaways from this book is look at the way your schools are like these prisons. Look at the way the factories are like these prisons. We micromanage every minute of our day.
That exact description is where I think that it fails to take into account something like the lessons of a real quantum mechanics. And I mean that utterly sincerely, in that this kind of way of talking about the micro organization is one that is still involved with direct cause and effect. It might be multiple causes and effect, but it's still classical in that respect.
Yeah, I don't think there's a good analogy to quantum mechanics in this, because
no.
I think it's more about decentralization of force. It's not about undermining the idea of force itself.
Maybe a better example would be evolution or something. Something in which the whole arises out of the individuals, right? Out of the actions of the individuals. And maybe that's part of what's going on there, or what he imagines being the better case, where you allow for a structure that has all the individuals acting together. But the kind of prescriptive behavior of a prison or a school seems to still be often top down.
Well, the idea of the non-top down part comes with surveillance and with people regulating their own discipline. The idea is that in the panopticon, you no longer need people to explicitly know that someone else is looking. They've internalized it, right? And so they do these things now of their own accord. And you certainly don't need to torture them. You just need to instill discipline in them, and then they behave in these ways of their own accord.
If I were listening here, that's about the second time we've used the term panoptical or panopticon, okay. And I think we have to define what it is, since it's so important, and we might as well do it now.
Go for it.
Somebody else.
Well, before Foucault, philosopher Jeremy Bentham wrote about this idea of the panopticon. The panopticon is a structure that has, so you've got a central tower where somebody in charge can oversee what's happening around them. And then you've got this sort of circle of individual cells around that central tower, where each cell would contain a single prisoner. They would not be able to communicate with each other or even see each other, but they can all be seen by this central tower. And the key feature here is that the prisoners can never see if there's someone actually in the tower watching them.
So one-way mirror. He didn't have that technology.
Yeah, right. It's a one-way mirror. Exactly. So the idea is, if at every moment there's a chance that you could be seen by an authority figure, you're not going to misbehave all the time, right? Because of the chance that you could be seen, you're going to end up surveilling yourself and internalizing that authority. So the beautiful thing about this is nobody actually has to be in that central tower. Nobody has to be exercising power in order for power to be exercised. It's brilliantly efficient in that way.
Yeah.
I like the elaborate image that he is painted in here. I mean, I haven't looked at the original Bentham work, but you know, it doesn't have to be just, you know, a single layer of cells. I mean, just imagine a sort of multi-story, almost spherical thing where you just have these cells at every possible angle, and there's some kind of little telescope or something that the person, they could be even very far away from the tower, but just, and they're all backlit. So this is sort of the opposite of what prisons were thought of before as these dank places. Like, oh, they're all open. You have a whole side open and it's not dark like these traditional prisons. It's, you're backlit. So you are extremely visible to whoever's going to be in the tower, which they could be looking at you with their little spy eye. So it could just be this massive, I don't know. I was picturing something out of Doctor Who or something.
This has to be the most evil thing, by the way, I've ever. Bentham.
And it's presented as a great reformer.
Yeah.
Right. So Bentham, he actually describes this as a prison, right? I mean, this is a plan for a prison specifically.
Right.
Yeah. And Bentham tried to get this prison made and was very disappointed that it never happened.
But he thought also that the structure itself, and this is what Foucault really takes off on, could then be applied to many, many kinds of organizations. Foucault says that even though this actual prison didn't get made, it was a pretty influential idea for a lot of kinds of organizations, so that you just try to structure. Yeah. I mean, cubicles in our office places are set up sort of like this, or just the way students are laid out in classes, et cetera, et cetera.
Yes, it reminds me of my attempts at privacy working in offices where I would basically make sure that my computer screen was not visible to anyone, despite the fact that often cubicles are basically designed so that anyone can walk by and see that you're not on salon.com or something like that. I would find another piece of cubicle and basically enclose myself in a little prison where at least there was some privacy and I could surf the web when I needed to.
That's the interesting thing about the Panopticon, is that it actually makes the dungeon look appealing, right?
Exactly.
Well, it also relies on the prisoner knowing that they are being surveilled.
Or knowing that at any moment they could be.
Okay, fine. But that's a distinction that doesn't make a difference. Right? The whole goal of it is having to work on the mind of the prisoner. But what I'm saying is the most important thing is that they understand that they are, could be, are being surveilled, right?
That's right, Wes. They're logging your internet activity.
And the reason that matters is that changes their behavior so that it's not, I mean, I understand this is the way it's supposed to be working. I guess maybe I'm reacting to the notion of it being a laboratory. There's this whole discussion in there about how now you can see the way in which people behave and understand the human soul, which is just not going to be true, right? Because you've now affected the way it's behaving.
But I think the larger important point is, how does power really work and how are people coerced into doing things? And I come back to this idea of recognition. And I mean, the idea is that much of what I do is governed by other people's expectations and opinions that I've basically internalized. And that's in large part how power gets exercised. And I think that's a really important point.
Yeah, I think to go back to what you said about the soul, I don't think it's so much about seeing the operation of the soul. The important point here is this is how the soul gets formed.
Right.
By creating this kind of relationship with yourself.
Exactly.
This self-monitoring, self-discipline. This is why Foucault says this is a genealogy of the modern soul. He's talking about how this concept of a particular kind of self with a particular kind of moral responsibility really gets inculcated, I think.
Yeah. Subjection is the creation of the subject.
Exactly. This is how subjects are formed.
I think somebody might have to slow down and walk me through that.
Well, yeah, maybe we should get at the transition. So now we've sketched out the beginning point of his historical story of the sovereign doing these nasty things. And then some of the reasons why that might have moved forward. The political economy wasn't working. And we have the end point, which is this idea of the panopticon, where even though part of it is a discussion of the structure of a potential prison, the larger implication, the reason why, again, say, the question for this episode should ultimately be, are we really free, is that the most effective way to fight crime, to keep everyone under control, is prevention, is to train your whole populace, to whip them into thinking that they could be observed at any time and to get them to internalize society's rules. And, you know, so that if there are any criminals, then everybody else will be looking out for them. It's the neighborhood watch. But the steps in between there, which I think is where this whole idea of the soul, or we've picked on the epistemological aspect of the panopticon, that by being observed, the leader is learning something about you, and that relates to this formation of the self. I think we need to say a little bit more about the shift there, which I think the first step in that shift is, and we were already saying, part of the reason people got pissed at the sovereign and the executions weren't going so well is because it seems so arbitrary. Who gets the death penalty and who doesn't? And are you getting the death penalty in horrible for shoplifting, essentially? So there is a need to objectify, to make some of these things more transparent, to actually get a legal code, to define all of the laws in particular and make sure they're carried out. So that's a first step.
We can go back to this formation of the soul thing. I mean, he's referring again back to Nietzsche's genealogy of morals, right?
Absolutely.
With the idea that the soul just is the thing that's sort of carved out when instincts get turned back inward. This is the Nietzschean version. And for Foucault, I think, it's a matter of internalization. When you're internalizing discipline under the sovereign, punishment works on the body, right? You're not trying to reform someone's character. We've left aside the concept of character at that point. The idea of discipline involves this notion of character, involves this notion that people, as Katie said, can monitor themselves. And now I think to Freud and this idea of the superego, where you internalize authority, basically. And so part of what it means to have a soul or a character, as opposed to just a body, is this internalization of authority.
Yeah, so maybe we should back up for a minute and talk about how that transition from focusing on the act to focusing on the character of the individual takes place. Because I think this is where we start to see Foucault's idea of the permanent link between power and knowledge, which is such an important idea of his. What enables disciplinary power to focus on the character of individuals is that we start by building up a knowledge of individuals. We start cataloging them according to certain scientific or quasi-scientific criteria. So I think Foucault's very concerned with the emergence of what he calls the human sciences, right? These would include medicine or psychiatry, things of that sort, where you are taking a catalog of individuals in their deviation from the norm. And you're saying, actually, I think a great example of such a catalog is the giving of grades in educational institutions. Ideally, we'd love everyone to be at the A level. You're a B. You, as a person, are a B student, right? So you are this far from what we want you to be. The D student is farther away than the B student. There's more effort needed to correct that. And individuals are carved out in that way. They're specified as individuals. And that creates space for getting at something interior. The more you know about an individual, the more you can develop strategies for bringing that individual closer to the norm. And so this constant surveillance, where you know everything about the individual, what they're doing at any given time, is going to be the most efficient.
Yeah. It's not just your knowledge, it's their knowledge of your knowledge, right? If you were giving grades in secret and the D student didn't know they were a D student, that wouldn't be such an exercise of power. It's
right.
The use of knowledge, and then the object of the knowledge is aware of, you know, I'm a D student.
Yeah. The examination has to serve as both the evaluation and the punishment or reward.
Yeah.
Simultaneously. That's why this works so well, right?
Yeah. And it's different than the torture because it's not just a one-off, right? People carry around their own torture inside of them. They punish themselves when they deviate.
Yes.
On a continuing basis. It's exactly. A superb way to make the person their own judge, jury, and torturer or executioner. And not simply rely on the political apparatus to do the work.
Right.
I want to just register a certain kind of disgruntlement in the following way, in that I understand and I'm in some way sympathetic to many of the grind that Foucault has about this, about the incredible weight of modern society about this sort of thing. But again, I just want to point out the fact that the notion of self-discipline and owning oneself is a very old notion. And the kinds of mechanisms that we're talking about are not simply the mechanisms of self-torture. I mean, at the very least in philosophy, they go all the way back to Socrates. Okay. And,
yes.
and so I just want to make this point that the characterization of this has one version of it in which you might even argue that it's a kind of perversion of it, a kind of abuse of the dynamic of the way in which the soul is formed by experiences of discipline, both from the outside and from within, and that the best version and flowering of the soul is one that is self-disciplined. And that's the only way of flourishing. But it gets perverted in some ways in this discussion, even by Foucault, where this constant emphasis on the debilitating effect of it. That's my disgruntlement.
So Foucault is completely aware of this. His later works from the period that follows his genealogical period, his ethical period. So, for example, The History of Sexuality, Volume 2 and 3. Are completely dedicated to exploring the idea of self-mastery that you get in ancient Greece, for example, and why that's not the same as what we're doing here.
And the positive elements of power. It's not just all negative. It's not,
right,
you know,
absolutely.
Power is bad, man. And
no, he never says power is bad.
Yeah.
Foucault has never said that.
And he explicitly talks about the positive effects of power.
Right.
Well, he did say it to me once, like in an off in a bar. We were drunk.
Were you in handcuffs at the time? Or?
Yeah, I was gonna say, was this after you were shopping for leather in Greenwich? Like, what happened here? So, moving on. Yeah, I think Foucault is highly ambivalent about this kind of self-mastery. He at times even thinks that it's good to have that kind of self-mastery in education. One of my favorite quotations that I like to throw at people who think Foucault's just all about domination is that he says, power is not evil. It is part of love and pedagogy. So there's something even about these examples I'm sort of flippantly throwing out about education that he sees as valuable. I think you're absolutely right to have this feeling that we really should be ambivalent about this, that this is not all negative. I think what Foucault is trying to draw our attention to is that some of the ways in which we have become masters of ourselves are actually doing us potential harm.
And I think, Dylan, I saw two criticisms there. One is this idea of, well, is this all bad? But then the other criticism is Foucault's historical account. Does that work? Especially if you're saying, well, this is what it means to be a subject. Well, then he's talking about something more universal. He's talking about, in the way that Freud talks about the superego or Plato talks about thumos or spiritedness, these sorts of things are just part of what it means to be a self-conscious human being, let's say. So why then concentrate on this particular transition? You know, and I looked at some of the history on this because I was curious to see whether people thought Foucault's got the history right. It seemed to me a little far-fetched, some of the generalizations. And so, yeah, there's quite a bit of criticism of the historical argument, right, that he's making about this transition during the late 1700s to the early 1800s. So I decided, well, I'm not going to worry about the historical thesis. I just want to think about the way that power works and whether some of that makes sense.
Yes, you're absolutely right. If Foucault is trying to say discipline or self-mastery is a completely novel concept during this transition, he would simply be wrong. I think his main background concern is about the rise of the human sciences and how easy it is to get this kind of dangerous self-mastery once you have this scientific way of studying individuals. It makes this kind of discipline so natural, so easy, so efficient, cost-free, right? It's just like a dream. This new body of knowledge allowed this type of power to function at almost no cost.
Yeah, and technology is part of that, right? You know, these basic elements are there, recognition and discipline and those sorts of things. But technology is intimately related to those things, and it's a multiplier. It allows recognition to function at a whole new level.
Yes, exactly right.
And so the nature of discipline changes. So if we read Foucault saying, you know, there's a radical change in the nature of discipline, then I think, yeah, it's interesting.
For anybody who has the edition of the book that has the red brick wall, the yellow noose, and the blue guillotine on it, the translator,
is there any other edition of the?
This is the standard edition. This is the one by Sheridan.
But just hearing you say that out loud is like the most hilarious.
Really? What's the green thing at the bottom?
Some kind of bear trap. Looks like a muzzle or a bear trap. I don't know.
Mine's covered up by my library
sticker, so I can't
tell.
I thought it was one of those scalp massagers. But
yeah, I'm like, it looks like something you would put on the head, but for what purpose, I can't imagine.
A floby?
Some kind of medieval torture device, maybe? I don't know.
Extracting the brain.
Oh, God. How innocent we are that we don't even know anymore what that is.
Yeah. The point I was going to make is that the translator, Sheridan, spends an extensive amount of time in the introduction or the preface saying how translating the word surveiller into English as discipline, it's like got all kinds of problems because the French word has many more nuances. So I think we shouldn't get too hung up on the word discipline. But I think to get back to Marc's point about the transition, Foucault says there's a pretty rapid shift historically, whether or not you agree or disagree with his historical analysis, because I'm in no position to judge the source material that he used. But whether or not you agree with it, he makes a point of saying, look, in a matter of 20 years or so, you go from a prison being a rarity and this public exhibition of punishment to this very intense discussion about a codification of punishments that are symmetric and consistent with the crimes, to eventually this system where imprisonment is the primary method for punishment, whereas before it wasn't. And he mentions that this seems to correspond with the rise of a mercantile class, the desire for this mercantile class to have a protection of their property. So there's a shift from crimes against bodies and persons to crimes against property. So there's a lessening, so to speak, of the severity of the crimes, but an increase in the number of crimes. And you have the sovereign doesn't have a vested interest in whether or not the shopkeeper's stuff gets stolen. But if you go poach deer on the sovereign's land, that's a different story. When you get to the point where there's a middle class that has an interest in protecting their property, and you have this change in class structure, this proliferation of vagrancy and vagabondage. You know, there's a lot of mentions of these bands of roaming vagabonds who are endangering the... Then there's this need to systematize. The system of punishment is not sustainable in this new economy or in this new set of social conditions. I think what Foucault is trying to say in the book is, you have this rise of a police force, you have a difference in a change in the way the state structure, but the state has to change the way that it imposes punishment. And this evolution to the system where you have discipline is a response to these changing social and economic conditions that is appropriate. I don't mean that in the sense of it's the right thing to do. I mean, you can understand why there's a shift.
Well, I like the nuance that he's got, that there's this intermediate stage, and it's not that he sees these as sort of a Hegelian dynamic where this point of history has to follow this one. It's just, this is how it happened to lay out, and you can see the logic of why things shifted given the sociological issue. But like you're saying, first it goes to, we need to codify everything, and in fact, we still want to keep punishment being public. So he talks about these work gangs, get the vagrants. If they're being vagrants, the thing that most obviously will deter that is to get those people on work gangs, like in public. So you can see this is what happens if you just lie around being shiftless, is we will make you get up and work. And in all sorts of crimes, they tried to make the punishment sort of fit the crime as closely as possible. So it's psychologically that deterrence would have the maximum effect. And it all stays public and it's supposed to be transparent. And this is where we get the introduction of having the investigation be transparent and all that. So that's all understandable. But then to make the move to this panopticon, this concern with the self, is sort of a further thing. And in fact, that is in the direction of making it more private again. But you can see the logic where it comes from, that once you get to codifying everything, then you also say, well, really, to make it really fair, we have to pay attention not just to what the person did, but who the person is. And like, are they likely to do that again? How much exactly do we have to punish them to ensure that they don't do it again? So that right there is introducing this. He says judges are no longer simply being judges. In other words, judging the guilt of the matter. They're judging things about the character of the individual. They're getting into psychology.
They're doing an examination.
And here's the other thing about that. There's got to be some motivation for why you give a shit. Why do we even care about this stuff? And I thought Foucault was saying that in the previous system, there's no need to reform them because they don't serve an economic or a political purpose in the system. Whereas when you get to the point where you have large groups of people committing crimes against property and so on and so forth, the bourgeoisie and this emerging social class needs workers. These people need to be productive members of society. So part of the reason why you care about paying attention to their circumstances for the purpose of theoretically getting them back into functional productive society is that you need this source of labor.
I thought it was just because the use of punishment as a deterrent would continue if it were feasible, if you could use it on all these, what we call microcrimes. But because of the disproportionality, it wasn't feasible.
It's overdetermined. There's a number of reasons.
And so you had to discipline people to prevent them from being delinquents, right? The delinquent as a character type, as a person predisposed to certain types of crime who has to be disciplined and educated in the other direction. I mean, being a regicide is just a grand one-off that you take care of with a spectacular torture and execution.
Those kids today all regicidal.
Being a delinquent, you can't, unless you want to start killing lots of people, you can only deal with them by coming up with a more devious and subtle plan, which is to discipline them into a different sort of character.
The switch to disciplinary power is overdetermined in the reasons for it. So on the one hand, the old kind of power doesn't work anymore. But yeah, you can't ship everybody off because you need them economically.
Okay.
I realize that we haven't read The History of Sexuality, Volume 1, but it was written at roughly the same time as Discipline and Punish. And in that work, Foucault makes a pretty big deal about the fact that one of the things that comes from this shift is the idea of needing to maintain a healthy, functioning population.
Right.
You have to keep society as a whole ordered, and it has to be able to maintain itself.
Yeah. Interesting.
Even if you don't focus on the labor aspect, Wes, you're right in pointing out that there's a need to deal with things differently because of the sheer mass. And I think the key point here is Foucault is saying that the human sciences emerge from this need to manage the population through the new power structure. So he's presenting a theory that says that the Geistwissenschaften weren't simply an attempt to apply the standard scientific method to human sciences, but that in essence, the power structure drives the need to create these sciences because we need those to manage the population and manage, you know, manage people and understand them in this system of control and punishment.
Well, you're also saying, Seth, though, that we, and I sort of answered my own question now that I'm looking back at the end of what I was saying, because I was saying that you can't just kill everyone off. And Seth, you know, you had just said you can't ship everyone off. So there's some sense in which people are necessary, right? You can't simply just obliterate everyone because a large part of the population is.
Well, why not just enslave them?
I think this is a better form of mastery. It allows a Although, who is the master here exactly? It's unclear.
I don't want to take us away on too much hypothetical, but is the short answer to why not slavery is that the cultural norms are just such that it wouldn't work? I mean, it worked in Rome, right? You have a centralized power, you have your slave as a part of your class, you can buy into slavery, buy out of slavery. It's not just a phenomena necessarily race-based, right? It could be part of an economy.
Yeah, but this is easier. This goes back to that economy of power. It takes a lot more effort to put somebody in shackles and make them toil the fields by day.
Roman slaves weren't like that. That's my whole point. That's not how slavery worked. I mean, I'm not saying
you're
preferable.
You're talking about Greek slaves, right, who were largely used for intellectual work.
Yeah, or castes in India.
The idea that I was trying to get across, even if I was talking about the wrong structure of slavery, I think the point is you have to make people feel the need to participate. If you can get people to think that it's in their best interest to play the role they're expected to play, then it's easy. Punishment becomes almost unnecessary. It all just works according to plan.
That makes a lot of sense. It's even if Roman slavery works, if there are examples of slavery that work, I mean, it still seems highly plausible that it's more efficient, that it's easier for people to regulate themselves than you to have to force them to do things.
Right, exactly.
And we are shifting from an economy that manifests itself on the body of the individual to the soul. And slavery is all about the economy of the body and controlling labor through the body. And that's so aside from all the other social forces that are going on around there, there's the fact that you're moving from that one system to the other.
What's so interesting about that point to me is that neither this particular form of power that's arising, nor the kind of knowledge acquired by the human sciences has primacy in that relationship. They go hand in hand. They're mutually reinforcing. Each is both the condition and effect of the other.
Can you say that again?
Power is both the condition and effect of knowledge. And knowledge is both the condition and the effect of power. You get a positive feedback loop.
In the sphere of psychiatry, medicine, criminology, the things he discussed, or you mean in general?
In general, and here is an example. Foucault thinks that specific forms of power are always going to carry with them corresponding, I don't want to say fields of knowledge, what do I want to say?
Epistemopolitical something.
Sure, right, yeah, right, something hyphenated, yeah, like he would. Power and knowledge always need each other, and what form power is taking informs which kinds of knowledge we need, and what kinds of knowledge we generate then informs the way the form of power takes shape.
Can we think of a specific example of changes in knowledge and power relative to each other?
There's one in this book, for instance, right?
Go for it.
His talk in the chapter on torture about the epistemic character. You know, so part of it was the idea of torture was they'd done this investigation. They already determined that you're guilty and they want you to confess. So they torture you into confessing. But there was something, the way he talks, it's like that was establishing the truth. In other words, truth as this political weapon that this is a piece of power. So that knowledge is an inextricable part of power. And in fact, part of the torturing process, how much should I torture you, is this knowledge of the physical body. So it was a technology of the body that was being used and has these epistemic elements buried into it. And then by the time we get to the panopticon, as we've said, you know, it's turned entirely clinical. And it still is a matter of controlling your behavior in some way. Instead of getting you to confess a certain thing, how many sticks to poke into you, it's a matter of how much I learn about you as an individual sort of patient to then condition you and train you to get you to play by the rules. So right there, to use language that's not nearly as inflammatory as Foucault's, it's that there's epistemology involved in all sorts of expressions of power. But he likes to put it sort of more graphically, more literally, that such that you might as well just say, if you say knowledge is power, that sounds like an academic.
It's great to learn because knowledge
truism,
is power.
Yes,
that's Bacon's formulation, right? Which is to say that by knowing things, we have power over nature and we make our lives better.
It's the power of manipulation.
That's the concept that Foucault is playing with and again expanding upon. So
you actually gave me what I should have said. You're absolutely right to point out the ways in which changing the form of power changes what even counts as truth, right? Before, what the truth of the matter was did you do it? And now the truth of the matter is, who are you? What kind of person are you? Are you a criminal person?
Right. And the fact that you, the judge, are setting the categories is determining how truths can be expressed.
Right. So power sets the conditions for making valid claims. It says these are the kinds of claims that will count as true. Claims about actions or claims about human nature. What kinds of claims are in the realm of truth?
Which is another way of saying whoever sets the terms of the debate has already won. That if it comes between just Republican, Democrat, or do you hate the country or not, or, you know, however you set these things up, then that's the power structure. And if you want to, you were saying with your dissertation, Katie, that part of figuring out how to have intelligent political action would be figuring out how from within that you can even have the language to criticize it.
Yeah. How do you shift the discourse? How do you change the conversation is a huge part of it.
Well, first of all, you make people say herstory instead of history.
Oh, God.
Oh, that shit irritates me. To know. You can't put this in the but because I'd be a bad feminist, but that shit irritates me to no end.
It's in, man. It's in. I'm not editing it. That's too good.
Well, Mark, I think you're just echoing a recent comment we received where the whole idea of doing a podcast on feminism was so offensive that they decided they were done with us, right?
Yes.
The very thought of it.
No, the whole idea of doing a podcast on feminism where we read Herland was so offensive that they discounted our entire enterprise in all 3 years and everything. Christ. Ignoring the fact that that was the book recommendation by a PhD teacher. Mm. I went back and forth about how to respond to that cocksucker.
Do you know how much of my cognitive energy is wasted on, oh, I have an example with two people. One of them is the criminal. One of them is the good guy. So the criminal should be the man and the good guy should be the woman. And all the pronouns I use that ought to be gender neutral have to be she, and freaking kill me.
This is exactly to the point. I think Foucault in this story here is, I think, nice and subtle. I read that later he thought that he kind of was overstating some of his points about how insidious power is and how much our current society is like the Panopticon. He kind of admitted that later. But it's still a vivid image and it gets you to think. And the historic, again, like you were saying, let's let historians judge the historical accuracy of the story he's putting forward. But it's a motivating and subtle picture here. And I like the funny juxtapositions of the technology of the body and the epistemic political, you know, jamming these things together, the microphysics, all this. But as soon as you imagine what an intellectual tradition built around people who admire Foucault is, it seems like it would be very unbearable. Like Foucault himself is subtle and interesting, but I looked up on iTunes U, I downloaded a feminist lecture about Foucault on sexuality, and I just had to about drive a stake through my head. And it's not because I hate feminism or anything like that. It's just this, it's getting into the things that people complain about postmodernism, the things that people complain about political correctness.
I completely agree with you. The secondary lit on Foucault in particular, I think the feminist and queer theory lit on Foucault, it's a disaster. That's not to say that there aren't theorists in those categories that I deeply respect. There are.
Yeah, you want to get a job eventually, right, Katie?
She still has a bright future ahead of her, unlike the rest of us.
I got to get a job in academia with these people.
This is all about convincing you to stay ABD and just do something else with your life. This is an intervention. This is a micro power.
Join our world of the philosophically undead. We wander the earth perpetually discussing.
No, I'm not cut out for a real job, guys.
All right.
I know that in large part the book is intended to be an analysis, and despite my disgruntlement, I didn't want to come off as saying I didn't get anything out of it, because I did genuinely enjoy reading it. I found it very stimulating. I just, when I got to the end, I really wanted to hear more about what the structures one ought to have. So in some ways, at the end, hanging over it is a kind of cautionary tale. And it falls in line with, you know, Brave New World and 1984 and all those other kinds of horrific versions of modern society. And I think that he leaves it open that it's in fact these very structures that could either be good or bad. They're not necessarily either way. So what I wanted to hear at the end was something about, well, okay, so what are the things you're going to have to pay attention to in making the structures of society so that you encourage human flourishing rather than reduce it to the slavery of the zombie white-collar worker?
I think I have a quote from his wiki page. It's not from this work. From Anti-Oedipus, Capitalism and Schizophrenia, and this is under the section of An Introduction to the Non-Fascist Life. So what he actually thinks that we should pursue, here he says, free political action from all unitary and totalizing paranoia. Develop action, thought, and desires by proliferation, juxtaposition, and disjunction, and not by subdivision and pyramidal hierarchization. Withdraw allegiance from the old categories of the negative, which Western thought has so long held sacred as a form of power and an access to reality. Prefer what is positive and multiple, difference over uniformity, flows over unities, mobile arrangements over systems. Believe that what is productive is not sedentary, but nomadic, etc.
He really wrote that?
Yes.
It's disappointing.
Can you tell me where that's from?
It says actually? It's from the preface to Anti-Oedipus, Capitalism and Schizophrenia.
That is not a canonical work.
It's on LSD. Oh my at the God. Time.
Mark just quoted from the Gnostic.
The Gnostic, yeah, Gospels. Right. That's exactly what he did. Yeah. Yeah.
I go to the footnote and it says it's from Deleuze and Gutiérrez, Anti-Oedipus, Capitalism and Schizophrenia.
Yeah, okay, yeah, good. It's Deleuze. Like
yeah. Deleuze and Gutiérrez.
Thank God.
Isn't that the food store in New York?
Sorry, it says, in the preface to this book, Anti-Oedipus, Foucault introduces the following principles. So it's the book is by Deleuze, but Foucault wrote the intro, and this quote is by Foucault from the intro.
Okay, can I tell you something about Deleuze and Foucault?
Were they lovers?
They did a lot of drugs together. And
shop for a lot of leather.
If you read Deleuze on Foucault, it's like, really? You guys were clearly sitting on the couch getting high and you thought this would be funny. I don't know what to say about this.
It still sounds like the kind of political thing that he should be advocating given what's in Discipline and Punish.
But it's just a sort of general bromides.
Yeah, it's not really prescriptive. It's not really saying anything,
yeah.
I think is the problem. He has later essays and interviews where he does get a little bit more prescriptive, but he so heavily tries to avoid that. He's got some later interviews and essays where he talks about cultivating an ethics of friendship, something like reciprocal relationships, cultivating symmetrical relationships of power among individuals. And he also talks about an aesthetics of existence, which is, in his mind, going to be very Nietzschean again. Living one's life as a work of art, looking inward, cultivating yourself, worrying more about making yourself a good person, whatever that means, rather than conforming to a code of conduct. So he makes a distinction between societies that have a code-based morality and those that have an ethics concerned with self-mastery, which is where he starts talking about the ancient Greeks again. That kind of self-mastery can be a good thing.
Yeah, I had a feeling this would lead back to virtue ethics somehow.
So it sounds like he said he's a Nietzschean, but then the end of the same quote says, do not become enamored of power. So it's the nice version of Nietzsche.
Yeah, it's unclear how Nietzschean he really was, even though he certainly thought of himself as, I don't know, a reincarnation.
Important part of power has something to do with recognition and social pressure, let's say, than with top-down authority. And that's what we should think about when we think about power. I saw that as accurate, and I thought a lot about not just Hegel and Freud and Rousseau, but even Plato, you know, Dylan, that you'd mentioned, the idea of spiritedness, which I see is related to recognition, the sense in which, you know, because spiritedness is related to what other people honor or dishonor and one's reaction to that. So I thought as sort of just a continuation of this tradition of explaining what the political order means, what civilization means, and how our behavior in reaction to the recognition of others, the knowledge of others, to get back to that relationship between knowledge and power, our behavior in response to knowledge is critical. So I thought it was very interesting in that sense.
Seth?
Well, I remember reading this book a long time ago and really liking it. And later on, I think I read it again, and I think you guys know, but I was involved with a nonprofit organization here in Austin that did offender reentry, that worked to help people transition from prison back into society. And so my lens for reading this was, I'd say, pretty narrow. And my impression of Foucault actually came from this book. So I had this sense of Foucault as a thinker who was very careful and meticulous and sort of Nietzschean in the way he approached things. And I always really appreciated it. And I have to say, reading it again, I had the same experience. I still, in fact, I'm enthusiastic about going and reading some more Foucault at this point, maybe specifically the history of sexuality. But I want to thank Katie and the rest of you for this conversation, because I think you guys helped me see the broader picture of what I guess he was trying to get across in this book, and this idea of the relationship between knowledge and power, even if I read it through yet a different lens, I think is really interesting and in a kind of weird way, terrifying. And if there's a lesson to be taken away from this, what Foucault is pointing out is that you need to be aware of the structures of power that exist and the types of knowledge that get created or that are the effect or the cause of that power structure. And that awareness of that is the first step towards being able to take a stance where you assert something about yourself or somehow break free of those structures. I can't recommend this enough to the listeners. I'm excited about future encounters with Foucault and other arenas.
You know, what you were just saying there about prisoner reintroduction, that if the point was made that our current society is a lot like the prison in this way, well, then the dude in the Shawshank Redemption who hung himself after getting out of prison wouldn't have done that. It would have been a smooth... Now, even if some organizations, the blueprint of it is influenced in some way by this panopticon, and we'll try to look at all the workers and we'll try to look at all the... Real life is much more, everybody's much more incompetent than that. And these things don't, right? All you need to do, as Wes said, is get another piece of cubicle and position your monitor correctly, and then they can't see it.
No, but here's, no, that's not true. I don't think any of you work for the company that I work for or work in the industry that I work in. But the whole thrust of technology, when you talk about information technology, totally supports this thesis. Nobody I know, nobody I work with would ever, ever put anything into an email that in any way, shape, or form could potentially negatively reflect upon them in the long term or the short term. And when you think about social media and how people are saying, look, everything lives forever, right? In essence, technology has become the vehicle whereby the fear of oversight, the fear of documentation of any misdeed now colors people's behavior. Listen, I'm experiencing this on a daily basis, right? I'm on Facebook. I have lots of friends on Facebook. I have friends from college. I have local friends. I have whatever. And they're of varying political stripes. And people will send me a link to something and it'll be like, hey, sign this petition so that Obama doesn't sign into law, you know, something that says that the military can come and act on U.S. soil, right? And your initial response is like, what the fuck? How could they do this, right? And then you go and you kind of read it. And then I'm like, well, shit, if I sign this, somewhere there's going to be a record of Seth's name on something. And whether it's the government or whether it's an employer, you know, and then I'm suddenly like self-censoring about the things that I like or share and the things that I don't like or share. I text stuff to people rather than send it through email. Not that texts aren't recorded, but at least they're not recorded by like by my employer. My employer can't subpoena text messages, I guess. So there's something to what Foucault brings up in this book about the way we self-regulate and that there's the system exists.
Just before doing this podcast, I was listening to a story in NPR about the government using these contractors who basically give the government the ability to install Trojans or a kind of virus on your computer, where not only does it record every keystroke that you make, but it can activate your webcam and your recording without you knowing it, so that if you leave your laptop on and the camera and the webcam happens to be, you know, in a good position, they can basically spy on you through your webcam. So I thought that was particularly appropriate. And the government is actively hiring these people, so obviously they're using these technologies.
Even if it's not true, what you just said, Wes, is the equivalent of having the mirrored glass in the tower in the Panopticon. It's just the mere threat that there's a possibility that you might be being observed change your behavior.
Yeah, and all of us who have been involved in tech know that, yes, anything I put in an email is not private.
Yeah, I think the internet has really done a lot to further this self-surveillance by the belief that you're being constantly surveilled. I mean, in the course of this conversation, I told you you had to edit out certain things that I said, because this is going on the internet for conceivably everyone to listen to. And that's terrifying.
Everyone will be required by law to listen to it, actually.
And we are on track for 100,000 downloads this month, so.
That's ridiculous.
A lot of people, for whatever reason, bizarre reason.
Hi, new listeners. Hello. Welcome to this feast of name dropping that tonight has been.
Really?
And we didn't give the rules at the beginning. Listen to some other episode before this one. I guess it's too late.
I thought
to say
we
that.
Had almost the least name dropping we've had in a long time.
Yeah.
Well, to be fair, we dropped the same names multiple times.
And Kant was not one of them.
Until now.
That's awesome.
Well, that's
true.
Damn it.
All right. That's not what name dropping is. Kant has already dropped. He's just there. Subsists in each.
The thing is, though, with new listeners, so we've warned people, and really, if you feel a little mystified about this, go listen to our episode zero, or I know we always say like you can listen to episodes independently, and that's true to some extent, but a lot of the things you're not going to get unless you just go back to the freaking beginning, or at least go back to relevant episodes like the Nietzsche one related to this or the Heidegger one to get all the references that we're talking about. And we shouldn't assume, I don't know if we can avoid assuming though, because of the cumulative nature of these conversations, that we don't have just new listeners who have never heard of any of these people listening to this one as the first one, and they have no idea what the fuck we're talking about. Hey, as we are nearing the real end of this, there's just two more points that I've been waiting to make here. Early on, when Dylan was talking about the physics of power and was saying that quantum physics, you know, doesn't provide a good analogy, but maybe evolution does. The initial thing that fascinated me with this book is the way he talks about the evolution of power over time. And it struck me very much like the Dan Dennett book on the evolution of religion, you know, memes. But then I read a little more and no, it's just because Foucault was raised in an atmosphere where everybody was doing structuralism. So these sorts of stories, and it ultimately does go that has its ancestry in Hegel. So it really, even though he doesn't believe Foucault in some overall end point of pushing history forward, he still does think of the progression of history as motivated as if, you know, a society had a collective unconscious or something that was churning over these ideas. And so you could call them social memes or whatever. So just to point out how unoriginal that term meme is. And the other point was just this, to cap off the comparison of this to Hegel's account of where we get the self. And we got this also in Sartre. So there's a quote just to continue that Katie had read early on. That this is all about the genealogy of the modern soul. This is on 29. Want to read a little more of that. He says, rather than seeing this soul as the reactivated remains of an ideology, in other words, like what the medievals saw, the Christians, which he on the next page refers to that as an illusion, and one would see it, the soul, as the present correlative of a certain technology of power over the body. It would be wrong to say that the soul is an illusion or an ideological effect. On the contrary, it exists. It has a reality. It is produced permanently around, on, within the body, by the functioning of a power that is exercised on those punished, and in a more general way, on those one supervises, trains, and corrects, etc. So I like the comparison there to, first of all, what we were just saying in the Sartre episode about how the self is built. The self is an objective thing in the world that other people have just as much access to as you do. But the sort of extra cynical sort of Marxist taint on this, that it's really just a historical byproduct that came up in this certain time. And I think that the difference here, right, Dylan was saying, oh, of course, people talked about character even back in the days of the ancient Greeks, that this whole discipline over your character, that's nothing new at all. But what he thinks, I think, is particularly new here is because of this historical progression of, you know, we're not punishing the body anymore. We want you to feel sorry about your action. We need to, you know, correct, we'll incarcerate the body. That's all we can really do with the body. But then we need to nourish your soul. So it's like, for Foucault, what the ancient Greeks might have thought of as a soul is very integrated with the body. You know, it's the body subject. It's the whole person. The character is the excellence of the person. You would have physical fitness in there as well as mental fitness. You'd have all these things in a nice bundle. But one of the things that we've done as a modern society is sunder the physical from the mental. In the fact that Foucault is tracing this sundering right to our mechanisms of punishing each other, of controlling each other, is a particularly cynical, naughty take on this that I like.
Yeah, you're absolutely right to pick up on the contrast with Sartre. One of Foucault's motivations throughout his works is to dispense with this idea of a transcendental subject. He thinks that's just hogwash.
Agreed.
What the subject is a product of a historical circumstance, and what a subject is changes over time. The second point that I wanted to make about that was he's pointing out the ways in which our own subjectivity is used against us as a means of controlling us.
But that's not cynical, right? I mean, if it's observational.
Okay, it's observational, yes, but it's cynical in the sense that the whole tradition of social philosophy aimed at criticism stems from an idea about actors who have certain fundamental features, a certain kind of freedom or human rights that are universal, that can't be violated. And we are the sources of critique. It is human individuals who criticize society. So if what we think, not just what we do, but what we even think, is so heavily influenced by the relations of power that we find ourselves in, how is that kind of criticism going to be possible anymore? Are we deluding ourselves when we're criticizing society? Are the very criticisms that we offer merely feeding into the power structure that we think we're criticizing? Because everything we do is a product of power. That's one of the most common questions people have for Foucault. And what I really hope to do eventually is to show that, yes, we can still criticize power and that we're not as determined by it as that makes it seem.
And it could be the nature of power to be self-critical, let's say, right? Power, if it's motivating people and pushing people, could lead to self-critique, right? Despite the fact that people are being motivated by power and you wonder, well, how can we critique the sense in which we're subjected to these power structures if that's what's motivating us? Well, that could be just simply part of the structure of power to create that sort of self-critique.
Yeah, power always comes with resistance.
Yeah.
That's one of Foucault's main points. At some point in his late works, Foucault even actually goes as far as to say that freedom is the ontological condition of power. For actions to motivate other actions, there have to be people who are free to make choices.
Right. This sounds like a lot like Newton's, I think it's his first law, right? The idea of force only makes sense if something resists.
Yeah.
That's the third one.
Well, that's every action is an equal and opposite reaction. But I'm thinking of inertia.
Oh, you think of inertia? Explain how that...
Inertia is intricately related to equal and opposite reaction because the idea is that the inertial property of something is just its potential to resist, right? It does what it does until it's acted upon. But until then... it does what it does.
I think I've learned that with five people, closings take a long time. That's my lesson. Anything else?
No, I think we've said everything there is to say.
We've said everything that is possible to say.
I could go on forever, but I'll spare you. So
maybe we can convince you to contribute some to the Partially Examined Life blog.
Oh, yeah.
All right. So look for some posts and or discussion by Katie there. Thank you so much, Katie, for coming on here. I know that we would have done...
Thank you, guys.
We would have done fine hashing through the social issues, but giving us the background of how this fit in with his other works and all that was invaluable.
Katie, you were fantastic.
Yeah. Great guest. Yes.
Thank you so much.
Would love to have you back anytime.
I had a ton of fun. I really appreciate the opportunity, you guys. I had a great time.
Next time, we're going to be reading Robert M. Persig's 1974 philosophical memoir, Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance. Please join us. Read the blog, partiallyexaminedlife.com, for more information about this episode, for other episodes. Listen to them 24 hours a day. Donate some money to us if you are a nice person. Be sure to go to audiblepodcast.com/PEL to help our sponsor think that we are worthy of being sponsored further. Follow us on Twitter, on Facebook. We have a raging discussions going on. Get on iTunes. Give us a nice rating. Send episodes to your friends and family. Worship us. Good night.
Good night. Good night.
Good night.
On your left, we see the zoo. Look, there's the zoo. If you look out the right side of the plane, you'll see the zoo.
And then
beyond the zoo is some clouds. I think they're like Sybaris clouds.
How do I get to the zoo?
And then if you look beyond the Sybaris clouds, you'll see the zoo. And then beyond the zoo, we turn left. It's like the post office. Don't go there. It's dirty. And then beyond that is the zoo. So you can go there.
Thank you.
Here we are.
I've seen you twice in the past 6 months. Once was in a dream. I followed someone I thought might be you. Went 2 blocks out of my way, then gave up. Even your imitators move away from me with some speed. You were never really in my life completely. You just watched it for a while, and then we moved on. In that short time you watched me, you caught all my idiot spots. Bad timing. Bad angle on the lens. Bad zoom. I came at you with an image in mind, an actress I'd seen. I just now saw a movie where that actress died, bringing symbols upon what? She and you are fixed in me. Now it's just solitary drama.